Welcome to Lethal Autonomous Weapons, 10 Things We Want to Know. This is episode 8, Can Humans Exercise Meaningful Control Over Lethal Autonomous Weapons? You're listening to an interview with Ingvild Bode, hosted by Paula Gaeter and Marta Bode.
Thanks a lot, Pravat Ryan, and good morning, everyone. I'm Paula Gaeter. I'm Professor of International Law at the Graduate Institute of International and Development Studies, where I lead a research project on lethal autonomous weapons and war crimes.
And I'm Marta Bo. I'm a postdoctoral researcher in the Lethal Autonomous Weapons and War Crime Project, led by Paula, and I'm a researcher at the Astor Institute in The Hague as well.
And in this episode, we discuss one of the issues that is at the core of the debates on autonomous weapons, namely the question of meaningful human control. Our guest today is Ingvild Bode, Associate Professor of International Relations at the University of Southern Denmark. Ingvild is also the principal investigator of an European Research Council research project on autonomous and international norms, auto-norms. And welcome, Ingvild. I hope I've spelled correctly your name, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It sounds wonderful.
So today we talk about your recent report, Meaningless Human Control, that you drafted with Tom Watts and published in February 2021. But before diving into that, we were wondering if you could give us a bit of background information about the debate on meaningful human control within the group of governmental experts on emerging technologies in the field of lethal autonomous weapons in Geneva.
Of course, yeah. So I think, as the listeners probably know, the debate about lethal autonomous weapon systems has started already in 2014 and has become a bit more formal since 2017 with the creation of the group of governmental experts. But ever since 2014, we already see that states have mentioned this issue of human control and to what extent humans can remain in control of the use of force when we use more and more autonomy or AI in weapon systems. And I think over time, this has kind of crystallized to become one of the key focal points of the debate, especially since 2017. And I think we see kind of a growing agreement that states share, kind of saying that we need some form of human control to remain over weapon systems. But of course, the kind of tricky bit is how do states understand human control? And what do we think is kind of the necessary quality of human control that is needed in order to retain control over the use of force? And I think here we see very different understandings emerging. So many states kind of seem to favor a kind of long view on human control in the sense that they think about how is human control exerted along the entire life cycle of weapon systems, okay, starting from the design of these systems to development and training and then to the use phase. And some other states, such as Brazil, I think, for example, are saying that particular phases of this life cycle are more important than others. So, of course, we have to make sure that in the design stage, human control is a part of how weapons are designed. But particularly in the use phase, so when we come really to decisions on the use of force, specific decisions on them, it is important that there we also have an exertion of human control because many states argue that really compliance with international humanitarian law depends on there being this deliberative human judgment over the use of force at the very end as well.
And in your report, Ingvild, you adopt a very interesting perspective with which we very much agree. So instead of looking at future military applications of AI, you look at current and long deployed military applications presenting autonomous or automated features. And you draw some conclusions about the erosion and the degradation of human control. So what are the changes that are already happening in the shape and form of human control over targeting?
I think what has always struck me as quite odd about the debate about autonomous weapon systems is the fact that it's so future-oriented. So quite often states talk about future weapon systems or that potential that are potentially developing. But as you say, and as I want to argue, there are many weapon systems out there already that have automated or autonomous features in targeting. So that means that there are some tasks or functions that these systems fulfill that are not only kind of motor or sensory tasks, but actually cognitive tasks. So they're kind of involved in the decision-making process on targeting. So the report looks at one particular type of weapon systems called air defense systems. So I've chosen to focus on this, first of all, with my colleague, because it's one of the oldest weapon systems to integrate forms of automation or autonomy. So since the 1960s, these types of weapon systems are being developed. So we actually have quite a long record of these systems being developed and used. So we can look at a lot of different instances in terms of understanding how they integrate human control. Often when the debate talks about these air defense systems, they are judged not to be so problematic because there's always a human in the loop. So this means that a human has the final decision on whether force should be used or not. So basically, a human has to authorize in some shape or form whether the weapon system releases force or not. But this was kind of, as I said, judged to be not so problematic because in the end, there is a human who makes the decision. But what I was kind of looking at in the report with my colleague is that to what extent is this decision actually meaningful? Because in the process of delegating, as I said, these cognitive functions to these weapon systems, this completely alters the role of the human operator. And we call this kind of a qualitative change in the role of the human operator. So they are, and actually we think that this qualitative change kind of means that on the one hand, the role has become more and more minimal, but it has also become increasingly complex. And I think this last part has not really been recognized or scrutinized.
The approach that you've taken in your report that, as Marta says, is very intriguing and very interesting to us. I've made the same point to one of our guests, speaking exactly on the question of the principle of human control that should be the key principle to be taken into account or to regulate future use and development of lethal autonomous weapons, namely that in the decision to use and to release force, the human operator could exercise meaningful human control. And I said to him exactly what you've said. I mean, but in a way, air defense systems and semi-autonomous weapons have already integrated some forms of autonomous decisions. And then the human in the loop would just decide to release the force. But still, I consider it problematic, as you said, because from what we have learned, I mean, to what extent a human can exercise meaningful human control in these, no? In these processes once a software has elaborated data with speed and capacity that a human being does not possess. What do you think in this respect? Do you think that the negotiations on the future treaty regulating the use of lethal autonomous weapons should expand to cover also these so-called semi-autonomous weapons? Or do you think this would be something not desirable for the negotiation process?
So what you said is whether I also think that the semi-autonomous weapon systems should be included in the regulation. And I think they should be. So the way I see it, if states can just ignore all of these other weapon systems that have already integrated automated and autonomous functions, that means that the eventual regulation, if it comes to pass, hopefully, will not be that effective. Because it then only regulates, I think it is in danger of regulating something that does not exist yet and is kind of completely detached from the whole kind of trajectory of weapon systems that we've already seen in deployment and in use. And for me, that is very problematic. I can kind of understand from a political strategic point of view, that's why states stay away from discussing these existing systems because they don't want them to be scrutinized and they don't maybe want to change their practices of using them. But I think from a regulative standpoint, it just means that whatever is negotiated will be unnecessarily futuristic and won't say anything about what is actually going on and what is, I think, the much more problematic incremental loss of human control that we already see kind of on the path now.
That's very interesting, Ingvild. I mean, just because I didn't mention, but the guest who has, on the contrary, taken an opposite view is Richard Moyes, who, of course, does recognize the problems that semi-autonomous weapons could have in this respect. But nonetheless, he considers it appropriate that at least we can focus on lethal autonomous weapons now that they are debating this. At least we can have this negotiations going on without expanding it too much. But I hear your view that, I mean, for you, it's also problematic that if we don't take into account semi-autonomous weapons and, let's say, the meaningless of human control in semi-autonomous weapons, we could accept, in a way, an unspoken norm, as you say in your report. And this is interesting for international lawyers, since often, you know, general principles and customary rules are formed out of unspoken norms. Would you like to expand a bit on this unspoken norm that we risk to that can take shape with respect to meaningless human control?
Yes, I mean, just to be clear, I think I'm not necessarily saying that we should ban semi-autonomous weapon systems, but I think we should scrutinize what they are doing to understanding of meaningful human control. And as you said, so my argument is that in the process of how these weapon systems have been designed and have been used in training personnel for them and have been used, we see kind of an emergence of a silent norm. So I'm not an international lawyer, so my approach for kind of making sense of this is from a political science perspective. And I think what is happening here is really this kind of silent norm, and it's I call it silent because it kind of comes out of these operational practices, and I think, to my knowledge, it has not been captured in this way in kind of rules of engagement, right? But it's sometimes verbalized, and how states speak about these air defense systems, and I think also to some limited extent in the debate at GGE on laws. So sometimes these weapon systems are mentioned and then by saying that they are not problematic, de facto they are reinforcing this silent norm, I think. And this reinforcement of the silent norm, I think, is even stronger if these systems are excluded then from the regulation, because that then just means that for me would then be a final acceptance of the precedents that these systems have set. Because then basically the case is closed, right? So there would have been the opportunity to discuss them, but it wasn't done. And I find this interesting, especially when we think about some of these newer systems. I mean, air defense systems are kind of maybe the oldest ones that are in existence, together with guided missiles. But then we also have loitering munitions, for example, which are a much more recent system and much less widely spread, actually, right? But also these don't really find mention. So I think for me also this interaction between kind of what is silent and unspoken and what is then verbalized in the form of these public debates is quite interesting as a process.
Ingvild, just for our listeners, so you mentioned GGE, the Group of Governmental Experts. Is it so?
That's right. Sorry, yeah, Group of Governmental Experts.
Okay, fantastic. And more specifically, in your report, you look at operational practices, indeed, in air defense systems. And you show that for some reasons, including complexity of these systems, but also automation bias, like overtrust, the control over these systems is indeed meaningless. Could you tell us more about the reasons why control becomes meaningless? So the reason why the reason that undermine human control over targeting in air defense systems?
Yeah, I mean, just to also maybe give this as a broad introduction, the report works a lot with literature and so-called human factor analysis. So this is a field of research that looks really at human-machine interaction. And I find it interesting, actually, that that this kind of literature has not really found a lot of mention in the debate on autonomous weapon systems. So to just go through these reasons that we use to explain the meaninglessness of human control. So first is this issue of complexity. Just by virtue of introducing code into targeting decision making, this increases, of course, the complexity of the system, and this is a problem because it means that humans may no longer have a functional understanding of the system. So they don't actually necessarily know how the system reaches its targeting decisions and on what basis. And I think this is problematic because this means that on the one hand, the human is there to basically critically assess to some extent whether force should be used. But if the human doesn't have a functional understanding of how the system makes these decisions, they can't actually critically assess that. So the complexity is therefore a problem. And just to give you, for example, an idea, something that also Richard Moyes talked about actually is this issue of how actually targets are calculated. And quite often targets are calculated in such a way that their target categories are quite broad rather than being quite narrow, because militaries basically want to avoid the risk of false negatives. But that then means, because the target categories are quite broadly calculated, that that then a lot of things can fall within the targeting space of the system that may be not targets, right? And this is kind of problematic, of course. So that's got the complexity issue. And then there's also the issue of speed. So one of the main military advantages for integrating these automated or autonomous functions was to increase the speed of operational decision making. But that also means that the amount of time that human operators have to make decisions on whether to authorize the use of force or not is also extremely limited. So many of these air defense systems, human operators have maybe 3 to 4 seconds to decide. So basically whether they want to veto a target that has been identified by the system or not. And of course, within that amount of time, it is highly doubtful that they can make a meaningful decision. So I think these are the two big ones. There's also the issue of situational awareness. So that, as I said at the beginning, the role of the human has become minimized. Which means that most often what humans nowadays do in operating air defense systems is just monitoring the system. And then, so they're basically underloaded with tasks for a lot of the time that they engage with these systems. And then when in a situation when maybe force is about to be used, they suddenly have to switch back on and suddenly find themselves in a situation of task overload. Because they have been kind of relegated to this role of being a passive supervisor rather than an active controller of the system, this means that they also lose situational awareness that is then difficult to kind of regain at speed. Yeah.
But Ingvild, have you found any accident where air defense systems have been have led to any unintended effect or consequence or false positive, as you said? I mean, in order to show us to what extent automated or autonomous features have impaired human control in some specific cases.
Yeah, I mean, the report mentions 4 different disasters involving civilian airplanes that have been wrongly identified as military targets by air defense systems. The most recent of these examples was just last year in January 2020, when Ukraine Airlines flight PS752 was shot down by Iran mistakenly, because they mistakenly identified, I think they thought it was a missile. This kind of happened just after the US killed an Iranian general in Iran via a drone strike. So this kind of was in a period of heightened tensions. But so then for some reason or other, the civilian airliner was misidentified and led to the killing of all passengers and crew on board. And that was just a normal commercial airliner leaving from Tehran airport at the time. And I think this, and this is just one of kind of the examples. Another really famous case is the case of Malaysian Airlines 17, which was brought down over eastern Ukraine in 2014. And I think that case, I think for me, really illustrates the problems associated with these air defense systems, because the air over eastern Ukraine is kind of one of the most prominent tracks when you go from Europe to East Asia. And it was just random that this particular airline was hit. It could have been any of the other airlines flying across this territory during this kind of space of time in July 2014. So, and I think this, for me, this kind of really brings it home, right? So that that these air defense systems are, then they're not just kind of problematic in an abstract sense, but they could actually lead to these disastrous failures involving civilian airplanes.
As you have already mentioned, these examples show how automated and autonomous features bring about challenges to human-machine interaction. And indeed, you argue that control through human-machine interaction is the fundamental component for ensuring meaningful human control. Can you tell us more about this specific aspect? You already mentioned the others, but if you want to put this in the specific context of the all three components of meaningful human control.
I think it has now become kind of common practice almost to think about human control along different dimensions. So there would be the technological dimension that is concerned with how the weapon system is designed or how autonomy is integrated, how basically targeting algorithms are programmed. Then the situational element that kind of sets limits in terms of where the system can be used and for how long, for example. And then for me, this human-machine interaction element or the decision-making element is the most important one, because that really, it boils it down to the actual decision when use of force should be used or when it should not be used. And for me, that is such a fundamental place for human control, because this is where, yeah, really judgment decisions are made about the use of force and whether the use of force is in compliance with international humanitarian law. So just to give an example, assessments about, for example, whether a particular use of force is proportional, whether it's necessary, and whether it's able to be used in adherence to the principle of distinction, so whether it can force can be used by distinguishing between combatants as potential legal targets and civilians as illegal targets. I think all of these decisions really depend on the specific instances of uses of force. So they can't just be kind of delegated to the higher ends of the human control understanding, but they have to be really there in the moment when force is used. So that's why I think this human machine interaction is for me the crucial part of human control. I don't want to say that this is the only one. But I find that while maybe states at the group of governmental experts originally were thinking more about the specific decision-making element, I find that the focus of this has become less and less present. So there's more and more focus on the earlier stages, which are important as well. But I think we should not forget about the use phase as crucial.
Would you expect, Ingvild, that indeed, since this aspect of the human-machine interaction has been left behind when it comes to the decision phase, so would you expect that perhaps the negotiations currently going on would perhaps be included this aspect in the treaty, in a potential treaty on lethal autonomous weapons?
I think I would. I mean, there are a lot of ifs connected to the progress of the current debate. I think I see a fair amount of very vocal states still making this point, such as, for example, Belgium, Austria, Chile, Brazil, these kinds of states, and they have made these points consistently, and they still make them. But I think we see also a lot of states trying to broaden the perspective of human control, and sometimes I think this is done in with good sense. As I also show in the report, also in my later research on this, that many of the decisions, much of the space of meaningful human control is actually determined at the design stage. So decisions that are made there shape whatever happens downstream. So that it is really important to think about the exercise of human control at the design stage. But so I think that there is a good chance of this being included. It depends a bit on what kind of compromise will be struck, right? Because I think we see a lot of the skeptics among the states' parties, such as the US, Australia, the UK, of course, Russia, being very forceful about there not being any need for new international law on law. So, I mean, I just wonder how it will all pan out. I mean, maybe there will be a political declaration, and I can see something like this being exerted. What I worry about, and I would be interested in legal perspectives on that, is so even if we have such an inclusion, it will be still the outcome of political compromise. So there will always be kind of room for maneuver, right, for states, because otherwise they would not sign up to it. I think, you know, so they would not have something that is so specific, you know, that there won't be any national understandings possible of it. So that's just kind of something I wonder about.
I was wondering if you realized you are almost running out of time.
Ingvild, this is Ryan. As you have listened to him already, he's a member of our team and he's a non-lethal robot helping us to keep time under control.
As usual, boss, I'll wrap up the interview with a final question. Ingvild, what are three adjectives that come to mind when you think of lethal autonomous weapon systems?
Wow, that's a hard question. I think potentially dangerous, in need of regulation. That's not an adjective. That's what I keep thinking about. And hard to define.
Potentially dangerous and hard to define? You make me sound like James Bond, Ingvild.
Excellent, Ingvild. Don't worry, because not everyone has been able to find really adjectives, but sometimes also long sentences could help. So thank you very much for coming on our podcast. And listeners, please tune in for our next episodes, where we will continue our conversations on lethal autonomous weapons, 10 things we want to know. Thank you so much, Ingvild.
And please do get in touch with us with your comments and suggestions. Tweet us at laws_warcrimes or email us at laws.warcrimes@graduateinstitute.ch.
Thank you again, Ingvild, and bye.
Thank you for tuning into episode 8 of Lethal Autonomous Weapons, 10 Things We Want to Know, with Ingvild Bode. The report mentioned in this episode is linked in the show notes. There you will also find our contact details and a link to our website, where you will find more episodes and read more about our lethal autonomous weapons and war crimes research project. Thank you for listening. Catch you in the next episode, where we will cover the question, how will lethal autonomous weapons change the future of armed conflict? Over and out.